Welcome to another Salvation by Grace midweek message. Salvation by Grace is the teaching ministry of Grace Christian Assembly, a Sovereign Grace Fellowship in Smyrna, Tennessee. You'll find us on the internet at salvationbygrace.org. We are currently studying the book of the prophet Jeremiah. So grab your Bible and join the congregation of GCA, along with our teaching pastor, Jim McLarty.
Tonight we are going to be looking at Jeremiah 50 in the biggest overview. What we're going to be looking at is Babylon and the judgments against Babylon, because they take up chapters 50 and 51. As you may recall, for the last few weeks, we were looking at prophecies and judgments against various nations that surrounded Jerusalem there, that surrounded Israel, some of whom actually received promises of restoration. For instance, at the end of chapter 49, we read, "But it will come about in the last days that I will restore the fortunes of Elam, declares the Lord." So even though he's planning to judge them for their sinfulness and for the way that they have oppressed his people Israel, nevertheless, some of them get promises of eventual restoration. So there is always an eschatological aspect to these judgments that we're reading here in Jeremiah, and that's important to remember. Some, like Edom and the Edomites, the descendants of Esau, Jacob have I loved, Esau have I hated, they don't get any promise of restoration. All they get is judgment. And then in chapter 50, we get into the big one, Babylon, because as Jeremiah is writing and prophesying, Jerusalem in particular, Judah, is in the Babylonian captivity. At the same time, Daniel is in Babylon, and around that time, Ezekiel is also prophesying. And so the prophecy against Babylon here goes far beyond the previous judgments that we have seen. The judgments that we have seen against these various groups, nations, cities, have all come true. We can all look at them in the course of world history, and we can see that they have actually occurred. The prophecy against Babylon, though, is really, really interesting. Babylon has a very significant presence throughout the Bible, whether we're talking about early in Genesis when we're reading about the Tower of Babel, that's the beginning of Babylon, or whether we're talking about Revelation 18 when we see an angel in heaven saying Babylon has fallen. There is this sweeping sort of sense of Babylon throughout the Bible as being emblematic of everything that God is against and everything that God is going to judge. And you're going to see that here again in Jeremiah 50. Because even though on the surface it might sound like God is just predicting the judgment that's going to come when the Medo-Persians conquer Babylon, he also says things that just simply have not been fulfilled yet, like the fact that their fall and their destruction is going to come from armies from the north. And he mentions that a couple of times. That's not the historic reality of the fall of Babylon. But also, and this is really, really significant, look at chapter 50 of Jeremiah, verse 4, which says, "In those days and at that time," so in the days of the fall, the complete destruction of Babylon, and at the time of that final judgment against Babylon, "the sons of Israel will come, both they and the sons of Judah as well, and they will go along weeping as they go, and it will be Yahweh, their God, that they shall seek. And they will ask for the way to Zion," that's Jerusalem, "turning their faces in its direction. They will come that they may join themselves to Yahweh in an everlasting covenant that will not be forgotten." Okay, so none of the previous falls and destructions of Babylon culminated in the return of the 12 tribes of Israel and the reestablishment of Zion, them living in peace and safety in an everlasting covenant with the Lord. None of that has occurred historically. Which, by the way, that one little prophecy right there, to my way of thinking, pretty much adequately destroys post-millennial thinking. Because post-millennial preteristic thinking says that everything predicted in the Old Testament has come to its fruition in 70 AD, especially prophecies concerning Israel. And they say that all of those prophecies of the fall and the judgment of God came to its ultimate completion with the fall of Jerusalem in 70 AD. Except that if that was the fulfillment, it's necessary that in those days and at that same time, the sons of Israel had come, and the sons of Judah as well, both northern and southern tribes, and that they went along weeping as they went, and they were seeking the Lord their God, Yahweh their God, and they entered into an everlasting covenant with him. None of that happened in 70 AD, which means either preterism got it wrong or Jeremiah got it wrong. I got to go with the post-mills got it wrong. So let's talk a little bit about Babylon before we even really get into this text. As I mentioned, Babylon dates all the way back to the Tower of Babel in the book of Genesis. And then it existed as a city there in the Middle East for centuries. It had become a major city. And when Assyria was in power there in the Middle East, Babylon was always competing with the Assyrians and rebelling against them. And so finally, Assyria just razed Babylon to the ground. I mean, just destroyed it. And then they began rebuilding. That's what we refer to as ancient Babylon. And then there's what's known as New Babylon or Neo-Babylon, the Neo-Babylonian period you'll hear historians talk about. That Neo-Babylonian empire was at its zenith during the time of Nebuchadnezzar and during the time of the deportation of Israel into Babylon. They ruled supreme there in the Middle East, but then they were defeated by the Medo-Persian Empire in 539 BC. In 331 BC, Alexander the Great and the Greeks entered the city after his victory over Darius III. And he spent lavishly in his intention to rebuild the city. He actually did plan at one point to use Babylon as his capital of his empire once he had finished conquering all the Persian Empire's eastern provinces. But when he came back to Babylon in 324 BC, he found that a whole lot of the funding that he had left behind for the rebuilding of Babylon actually was embezzled by the appointees and city leaders that he left behind. That sounds familiar, because people don't change. Give people a whole bunch of money, they're going to take it. They're not going to do what the leaders tell them to do. Anyway, so Alexander died in 323 BC, and he left Babylon essentially in the state that he had found it. And by then, it was beginning to run down. Now, as you may recall from our study in the book of Daniel, after Alexander the Great died, Daniel had predicted that his power, his authority, was not going to go to his progeny, not to his family. And certainly that happened. Even though Alexander the Great had a son, Alexander's empire went to his four generals. And the primary of those generals, the one that we talk about here, is Seleucus Nicator. And the Seleucid Empire, because that's the empire that took up Jerusalem. They kind of picked up where the previous nations had left off in ruling over Jerusalem. And in 311 BC, Seleucus Nicator captured Babylon. And he pried Babylonia away from Antigonus, who was one of the other generals that was in charge of the tetrarchy that was left behind by Alexander. And then it just continued to kind of decay. The city of Babylon ceased to exist as a major urban center sometime between the 6th and 7th century AD. By the 7th century, it had been reduced to little more than a tiny village. The city had been largely abandoned. And the conquest of the region by the Muslim Arab armies in the 7th century AD marked the effective end of the Babylonian city and its urban centers and its empire. Okay, so did any of that, the reason I went through it, were any of those defeats by armies of the north? Well, no. And yet the prediction that we're going to read here in Jeremiah 50 is that the ultimate downfall of Babylon is going to be armies from the north gathered by God, and that at that time when that defeat takes place, in those days God is going to regather and reestablish Israel, and that they are going to enter into an everlasting covenant with him, and that just simply has not happened anywhere in human history. And so Babylon continues to have this significance, even though the city itself has fallen. Back when we were reading out of the book of Isaiah, and by the way, you can turn there if you'd like for a moment, because we are going to read a little bit. Isaiah 13 is where we're going to pick up. Back when we were teaching through Isaiah and we were talking about the predictions of the fall of Babylon, which, by the way, the predictions of Isaiah of the destruction of Babylon were a full century, a full 100 years before Babylon was even a significant power in the Middle East. It was basically just kind of one of the many cities living in relative obscurity when Isaiah wrote about it. But Isaiah is the same prophet who 150 years in advance predicted Cyrus by name, who was the king of the Medo-Persians. And so Isaiah correctly predicts that Babylon is going to conquer Jerusalem, is going to take God's people captive, but then they're going to be able to come back to rebuild the city and rebuild the temple. And that's going to happen during the time of Cyrus the Mede. And he gets all of that accurate, but he's also predicting it a century before Babylon even is a superpower in the Middle East. So these are really significant prophecies that have come true in time and history. We know when Isaiah wrote it, and we know what happened after that. And Isaiah has this remarkable ability to tell the future in advance. So let's start reading at Isaiah 13, the oracle concerning Babylon, which Isaiah, the son of Amoz, saw. Lift up a standard on the bare hill, raise your voice to them, wave the hand, that they may enter the doors of the nobles. I have commanded my consecrated ones, and I have even called my mighty warriors, my proudly exulting ones, to execute my anger. A sound of tumult on the mountains, like that of many people. The sound of an uproar of kingdoms, of nations gathered together. The Lord of hosts is mustering an army for battle. They are coming from a far country, from the farthest horizons. The Lord and his instruments of indignation will destroy the whole land. From that bit of prophecy, which is going to be very similar to what Jeremiah talks about, from there, he launches into Day of the Lord language. And we know that the Day of the Lord is the final culmination of the wrath of God that happens at the end of this time of trouble, such as never was or ever would be again. Verse 6 starts, wail, for the Day of the Lord is near. It will come as a destruction from the Almighty. Therefore, all hands will fall limp and every man's heart will melt, and they will be terrified. Pains and anguish will take hold of them. They will writhe like a woman in labor, and they will look at one another in astonishment, their faces aflame. Behold, the day of the Lord is coming, cruel with fury and burning anger, to make the land a desolation. And he will exterminate its sinners from it, for the stars of the heavens and their constellations will not flash forth their light, and the sun will be dark when it rises, and the moon will not shed its light. Thus I will punish the world for its evil and the wicked for their iniquity. And then after going on to describe this terrible day of the Lord, starting at verse 17, we read the prediction that Babylon is going to fall to the Medo-Persians. Again, remarkable that Isaiah is able to predict this. Isaiah is actually prophesying at 742 BC. And the fall of Babylon to the Medes happened in 539 BC. How did he know all this? And how did he get these details so exactingly correct that far in advance? Behold, I'm going to stir up the Medes against Babylon, who will not value silver or take pleasure in gold, and their bows will mow down the young men, and they will not even have compassion on the fruit of the womb, nor will their eye pity children and Babylon, the beauty of kingdoms. The glory of the Chaldeans' pride will be as when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. And it will never be inhabited or lived in from generation to generation, nor will the Arab pitch his tent there, nor will shepherds make their flocks lie down there. But desert creatures will lie down there, and their houses will be full of owls. Ostriches will live there, and shaggy goats will frolic there, and hyenas will howl in their fortified towers, and jackals in their luxurious palaces. Her fateful time also will soon come, and her days will not be prolonged. When we were studying in Isaiah and talking about this, several of us saw a video that's currently on YouTube of an archaeologist who went back to Iraq and found the area along the Euphrates River where Babylon would have been. And he was able to kind of map out where the city walls would have been. And it is currently desert. And in fact, one of the more amusing parts of the video is that while he was filming, the very fact that Great Babylon was nothing but dust and sand now, as he was filming, there were jackals, exactly like God said that Babylon would become a haunt for jackals. After that, there is what the NASB calls Israel's taunt. The Lord will have compassion on Jacob and again choose Israel and settle them in their own land. Then strangers will join them and attach themselves to the house of Jacob. And the peoples will take them along and bring them to their place. And the house of Israel will possess them as an inheritance in the land of the Lord, as male servants and female servants. And they will take their captors captive, and they will rule over their oppressors. And it will be in the day when the Lord gives you rest from your pain and your turmoil and your harsh service in which you have been enslaved, that you will take up this taunt against the king of Babylon. Okay, that hasn't happened. Israel has not returned to their land in peace and safety in such a way that they're able to take up this taunt against Babylon. And yet Isaiah and Jeremiah combine the idea of the destruction of Babylon with the idea of the restoration of Israel. So even though we can look back historically, even though we can look at the video on YouTube and say, yes, just like the Bible said, the city of Babylon is destroyed. And yet the character of Babylon, the spiritual impetus of Babylon continues to this very day and continues, as I said, into the book of Revelation, into Revelation 18 and the cry from the angel that Babylon has finally fallen. So Babylon throughout the Bible is much more than just a city. Babylon is a spiritual and geopolitical influence in the world that seems to sum up everything that is not godly. The systems of this world, the governments of this world, the politics, the finance of this world, all seems to be subsumed under this heading of Babylon. And it's not until Christ returns in judgment that Babylon is finally going to be utterly eradicated. Because, as I said, Babylon as a concept runs all the way through the Bible. Now, there in Isaiah 14, the next thing we're going to read is this taunt that they take up against the king of Babylon, who is Nebuchadnezzar at that point. That's the king he seems to be referring to. But in the midst of that taunt, God speaks right past Nebuchadnezzar to the demon that's controlling him and refers to that demon, to Satan directly. Here's the language. It starts with how the oppressor has ceased and how the fury has ceased, and the Lord has broken the staff of the wicked and the scepter of rulers, which used to strike the peoples in fury with unceasing strokes, which subdued the nations in anger with unrestrained persecution. The whole earth is at rest and is quiet, and they break forth in shouts of joy. Even the cypress trees rejoice over you and the cedars of Lebanon, saying, since you were laid low, no tree cutter comes up against us. By the way, has there been any tree cutting still happening in the Middle East around Lebanon? We'd have to say, yes, there's still construction going on over there. But there's this time of peace and safety coming. Sheol, the grave from beneath, is excited over you to meet you when you come. It arouses for you the spirits of the dead and all the leaders of the earth. It raises all the kings of the nations from their thrones. And they will all respond and say to you, even you have been made weak like one of us. You've become like us. Your pomp and your music of your harps have been brought down to Sheol, down to the grave. Maggots are spread out as your bed beneath you, and worms are now your covering. How have you fallen from heaven? And in verse 12, God speaks past Nebuchadnezzar as the king of Babylon and speaks to Lucifer himself, who controlled the demonic activity of Nebuchadnezzar and by extension, Babylon itself. How have you fallen from heaven, O star of the morning, son of the dawn? That word is literally Lucifer. You've been cut down to the earth, you who have weakened the nations. But you have said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven. I will raise my throne above the stars of God. I will sit on the mount of the assembly in the recesses of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds, and I will make myself like the Most High. Back in the book of Genesis, do you remember what the problem was with the Tower of Babel? The intention of the Tower of Babel was to reach to the heavens. And because everybody still had one language, God confused their language, scattered them so that they would not try again to rebuild this tower up into the heavens to make themselves like gods. Have you ever heard of etymenanki? Do you know that word? Use it in a sentence later. Impress your friends. That was actually a ziggurat. Do you know a ziggurat? It's like a pyramid structure with levels that builds up into a giant tower. And Babylon was in kind of a raised place, and then in the center of Babylon was this giant ziggurat reaching up to heaven, doing the same thing that the Tower of Babel had done. Literally, that word, etymenanki, Literally, that word means the temple of the foundation of heaven and earth. And it was dedicated to the Mesopotamian god, Marduk, who, you're going to see in Jeremiah 50, God calls out by name and says he's going to destroy him because his temple is trying to reach up to heaven. He's still trying to reach up and make himself God, which was always Satan's desire from the very beginning. Even when he was talking to Eve in the Garden of Eden, he was denying God. He was saying, didn't God say? Well, he didn't mean that, because he knows the day that you'll eat it, you'll be like God. That idea of being like God permeates Satan's thinking and his desire to be like God. And in this judgment against Nebuchadnezzar, as God speaks past Nebuchadnezzar to Lucifer, who's driving him, he accuses him and says, you said in your heart, I'll ascend to heaven, and I will raise my throne above the stars of God, and I will sit in the mount of the assembly in the recesses of the north, and I will ascend above the heights of the clouds, and I will make myself like the Most High. Nevertheless, you shall be thrust down to Sheol, to the recesses of the pit. And those who see you will gaze at you, and they will ponder over you, saying, is this the man who made the earth tremble, who shook kingdoms, who made the world like a wilderness and overthrew its cities, who did not allow his prisoners to go home? All the kings of the nations lie in glory, each one in his own tomb. But you have been cast out of your tomb like a rejected branch, clothed with the slain who are pierced with a sword, who will go down to the stones of the pit like a trampled corpse, and you will not be united with them in burial, because you have ruined your country, you have slain your people, and may the offspring of evildoers not be mentioned forever. Okay, so God started by talking to Nebuchadnezzar. He ended by talking to Nebuchadnezzar. And in the middle, he talked to Lucifer, who was driving Nebuchadnezzar. And he accuses him and says, you want to be like God. Nebuchadnezzar's primary building projects were to try to build up his ziggurat to God. He was trying to be like God. And he was worshiping Marduk, who was worshiped as the founder of heaven and earth, a name that only Yahweh has. He alone identifies himself accurately as the maker of heaven and earth. So you can see the offense that God takes to the idea that some other man-made God is the maker of heaven and earth. That idea, that concept, that spiritual idea is still alive and well in the earth. Human beings are still trying to make themselves God. There are all kinds of religions in the world that are still trying to redefine God or say that it is their God or their mythology or their pantheon that is responsible for the creation. All of that is an insult against the God who actually made everything, heaven and earth. And so you could see why it is that God would point at Babylon and say, that worship, that idea, that spiritual concept driven by Lucifer is still alive and well in the world and will be until Christ finally comes to establish his kingdom, and then finally Babylon will be wiped out. Got it?
Got it.
Okay, that was all introduction. Boy, I gotta move. By the way, since I had just talked about this at a Menenke, ancient Babylon was destroyed in 689 BC by Sennacherib. This is, again, is ancient Babylon, not Neo-Babylon. He claims to have destroyed the Etemenenki. It took 88 years to then restore the city. Work was started by the Assyrian king, Esarhaddon. It was then continued under Nabopolassar, who was then followed by his son Nebuchadnezzar II, who rebuilt the ziggurat. The city's central feature was this temple to Marduk. That's all leading up to what we're about to read here in Jeremiah 50. Turn to Jeremiah 50. Now I think you'll have a greater understanding of why God calls out that particular God. The word which the Lord spoke concerning Babylon, the land of the Chaldeans, through Jeremiah the prophet. Declare and proclaim among the nations. Proclaim it and lift up a standard. Do not conceal it, but say Babylon has been captured. Bel or Baal, their gods, have been put to shame. Marduk has been shattered. That means his ziggurat's coming down once and for all. And his claims to actually be God, his claims to actually set up his worship in the place of the north, his claims to be higher than all the residents of heaven will once and for all be utterly shattered. Babylon's images have been put to shame, and her idols have been shattered. This is in keeping with what we've seen in all these previous judgments in the book of Jeremiah. Not only does God judge the cities and the residents of the cities, but each of those cities have gods that they worship, gods that they thought were going to protect them. But when the God of Israel, the real God, the maker of heaven and earth, when he comes and attacks them, he mocks their gods. And that goes all the way back to the deliverance of Israel out of Egypt. The 10 plagues that were brought on Egypt. Each one of them was particularly against a particular god of Egypt, whether it was a god of the Nile or the god of the frogs or the god of the bugs and the lice. Even the god of light, the sun god, Ra, when the darkness overtook them. And their gods were powerless to deliver them from the hand of Yahweh, the real God. So here again, in talking about Babylon, God, Yahweh, says that he's going to shatter their gods and their images. All the things that they worship are going to be put to shame because they're not going to be able to protect those people from the real God and the wrath of that God. For a nation has come up against her out of the north. It will make her an object of horror, and there will be no inhabitant in it. But man and beast have wandered off, and they have gone away. Isaiah's prophecy was that once the city was destroyed, it was still going to be a land inhabited by beasts, birds and ostriches and jackals and hyenas. But here in the ultimate destruction, the ultimate wipeout of Babylon, Jeremiah includes that both men and beast will be out of it. And so historically, even though we can see the destruction of the city of Babylon, it's been destroyed several times and then rebuilt and then finally destroyed, like Isaiah said, and not rebuilt. And yet, never once was it armies of the north that did the destroying. Jeremiah says very specifically that a nation has come up against her from the north. And in a moment, he's going to elaborate on that and say that God is going to assemble his armies from all various different nations who are going to come down on Babylon from the north. But first, he interjects this about Israel. In those days and at that time, declares the Lord, the sons of Israel will come, both they and the sons of Judah as well, the northern tribe, the scattered tribe, which in a moment he's going to refer to as his lost sheep. And also Judah, who at the time that Jeremiah is prophesying, are actually in Babylon. And yet Israel is going to come, both they and the sons of Judah as well, and they will go along weeping, repenting as they go. And it will be that Yahweh, their God, that's whom they're going to seek. They will ask for the way to Zion, and they will turn their face in its direction. They will come that they may join themselves to Yahweh in an everlasting covenant that will not be forgotten. My people, says God, my people Israel have become lost sheep. Really significant. During Jesus' 3.5-year ministry, as he was sending his apostles out 2 by 2, telling them to go preach the good news, the gospel of the kingdom, he told them specifically, don't go into the way of the Gentiles. In fact, he went so far as to say, don't go into the area of the Samaritans. And don't go to the Gentiles. Go first to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. And Jesus even said, I am not sent but for the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Where is he getting that language? From back here in Jeremiah, where God himself says, my people, Israel, have become lost sheep. Now that has to mean something. It wasn't until Jesus died and raised again. It wasn't until after that that we read Jesus telling his apostles, all authority is given to me, so now go to all nations, make disciples, baptize them, tell them everything I've told you. But that's not until his death, burial, and resurrection. Before that, he told them specifically, only go to the lost sheep of the house of Israel, because that's who my ministry is to. And that's significant in our understanding of the ministry of Jesus, especially on Sunday mornings as we continue harmonizing the Gospels and looking at the specific ministry that Jesus had. Their shepherds have led them astray. They have made them turn aside on the mountains, and they have gone along from mountain to hill, and they have forgotten their resting place. In other words, they're just wandering. They're going from hill to hill. They're going from mountain to hill. They don't have their resting place because they're out of their land. All who came upon them have devoured them. That's true. They've lived the vast majority ever since the Assyrian captivity all the way to Nebuchadnezzar and then all the way to the Roman Empire in the time of Jesus. Finally, to the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD, they have always been under the boot of some other Gentile nation. All that have come upon them have devoured them. Their adversaries have said, we are not guilty, inasmuch as they have sinned against Yahweh, who is the habitation of righteousness. So even the enemies have an excuse. Even those people who have conquered Israel are going to say, it's Israel's fault, and God agrees through the early chapters of Jeremiah that it's Israel's fault, it's their sinfulness, it's their abandonment of the law of God and his precepts that is the reason that he is bringing this judgment and this scattering on them. And so their enemies who scatter them can say, it's not us, we're not guilty, it's not our fault, we didn't do it, because they sinned against Yahweh, who is the very center, the very habitation, the very home of righteousness. Which is why the Bible argues that genuine holiness and righteousness is not going to break out on planet Earth until the Prince of Peace, the King of Righteousness, returns to the planet. Which is significant to remember because every so often we as Christian people look at this world and we think, where's the righteousness? Where's the holiness? Where's the goodness and the fairness? We expect sinful people, rebellious people, to just do better. And they don't because they can't. And that's why elections go the way they go. And that's why governments become as corrupt as they are. And we're talking about all human government. We read history about the corruption of these various historic governments, and we think, well, America's better. No, America is governed by people, and that's why our government is corrupt. Because people don't change until the very habitation of righteousness breaks out on this planet. They have sinned against Yahweh, who is the habitation of righteousness, even Yahweh, the hope of their fathers. Wander away from the midst of Babylon, and go forth from the land of the Chaldeans. Be like male goats at the head of the flock. The male goats are the ones that led the flock, saying, even if nobody else is going, you go, others will follow you. For behold, I'm going to arouse and bring up against Babylon a horde of great nations. Oh, not just a few, not just a handful of nations, but great nations and a horde of great nations from the land of the north. And they will draw up their battle lines against her. And from there, she will be taken captive. Their arrows will be like an expert warrior who does not return empty-handed. And Chaldea will become plunder, and all who plunder her will have plenty. In other words, the plunder is not going to run out. And Chaldea will become plunder. All who plunder her will have enough, declares the Lord. Because you are glad, because you are jubilant, O you who pillage my heritage. In other words, you who have oppressed my people Israel, because you skip about like a threshing heifer. Have you ever seen a calf in a field just skipping about? He says, that's what you people do. You destroy my people and then you jump around happily because you think you're the merry conquerors, because you skip about like a threshing heifer and then you neigh like stallions. You make big noise. Because that's what you're like, your mother will be greatly ashamed. She who gave you birth will be humiliated because she will be the least of the nations. A wilderness, a parched land, and a desert. Because of the indignation of Yahweh, she will not be inhabited, but she will be completely desolate. Everyone who passes by Babylon will be horrified and will hiss because of her wounds. We'll stop right there for tonight. We will pick up in verse 14 next week. It'll take us a couple weeks to get through chapter 50 and chapter 51. I hope what you're seeing by that introduction is that even though the city of Babylon has fallen several times in history, it's never been accomplished quite this way. Never by hordes of nations coming down from the north. There is yet a final destruction, a final wiping out of Babylon. By the way, when I say Babylon, do you know where that is on the map right now? It's 50 miles south of Baghdad in Iraq. So what's north of that? And never has that been the area. It's been from the east, it's been from the west, it's been from the south. But never have hordes of armies come down from the north and conquered Babylon and wiped it out. So that still has to happen, which means that even though the city is gone, there is something about Babylon that is yet to be utterly destroyed. Before we go, I know I said we're done for the night. Turn to Revelation 18. Just listen to these words. I'm going to start reading at verse 1. I'm going to read the first five verses just so that you get this sense that just like Jeremiah was predicting such an ultimate fall of Babylon that it went far beyond just the destruction of the city, it was the end of the whole system that was embodied in Babylon and the worship that took place in Babylon. By the way, when I say the worship that took place in Babylon, I'm talking about what is known as Babylonian mystery religion. Babylonish mystery religion still exists today. It's just been reformed and bent into a new shape and now is primarily in the Catholic Church. And there's just no way around that. Which is why there are books by like Alexander Hislop, who wrote The Two Babylons, where he compared ancient Babylonian worship to modern day Catholicism. My point in saying that at this moment is not to stump against the Catholics, but to say that worship, that ancient worship from Babylon, still alive and well. It's still here in the world. And that desire to bring down the God of heaven and exalt men is still in the world. But Revelation 18, verse 1 says, after all these other things, after the victory of Christ coming back, after these things, I saw another angel coming down from heaven, having great authority, and the earth was illumined by his glory. And he cried out with a mighty voice, saying, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. And she has become a dwelling place of demons and a prison for every unclean spirit and a prison for every unclean and hateful bird. For all the nations have drunk of the wine." Notice that. All the nations of earth have drunk of the wine of her passion, of her immorality. And the kings of the earth have committed acts of immorality with her. And the merchants of the earth have become rich by the wealth of her sensuality. And I heard another voice from heaven saying, "Come out of her, my people." Doesn't that sound similar to what we just read out of Jeremiah? Where he said, "Flee like male goats, get out of Babylon." I heard another voice from heaven saying, "Come out of her, my people, that you may not participate in her sins, and that you may not receive of her plagues, for her sins have piled up as high as the heaven." Isn't that interesting? Because the Tower of Babel was built for the purpose of reaching as high as heaven. And God, in mocking them, says, "It's your sins that have reached as high as heaven. It's not your building projects or your desire to make yourself like God that ever reached up to the heavens. Your sins have piled up as high as heaven, and God has remembered those iniquities." You can see why God's upset about Babylon and why he's going to judge Babylon. It's thematic all the way through the Bible. And it's so much more than just the city being destroyed. And there are direct parallels, obviously, between Revelation and what Jeremiah is predicting in Jeremiah 50. So, all right, I'll shut up for the night and let you go home. I hope you found that interesting. I have been fascinated in reading about it and studying about it. And I have had to edit like mad to get it down to just this form, because there is so much about Babylon that you can find on the internet, in commentaries, in books. Babylon looms very, very large in the economy of God. But he's going to destroy it. And when he does, his people Israel are going to be regathered back into their land. So clearly, that's an eschatological prophecy. Okay, this time I'll really shut up. Questions? Comments, interpretive dance. Yes, sir, Steve. Interpretive dance, is that what we're in for?
Not tonight, I'll do that.
Oh, okay. I'll look forward to
that. I wouldn't have known about this guy, speaking about guys who like to make themselves gods. I wouldn't have known this. I saw this guy on the news the other day. His name was called Charlemagne the God. Anybody ever heard of him?
Yeah, right.
Anyway.
Yeah, he's a rapper.
Yes.
Yeah, see, to this very day, people want to be a god. Yeah. Well, what did you say last night about the heavy metal band called Lamb of God? A title of Christ. This world is still steeped in Babylon and in everything that Babylon embodies. Did you have your hand up?
Who do you believe the armies of the north are?
Who do I believe the armies of the north are?
Yes.
I don't know. I have theories, but I don't know. I'm not going to say. I can tell you, there are a horde of nations and a bunch of armies who are all going to finally turn against Babylon, just like Revelation says. Anything else? All right, then.
Thank you for listening to this week's Salvation by Grace midweek message. We encourage you to visit our website at salvationbygrace.org for books, Q&As, and our ever-expanding archive of audio sermons. And we invite you to join us next time when we gather around the Word and study the sovereign grace of God.